For two painful years, the city of Boston was forced to relive the horror of the 2013 marathon bombings again and again. In the days following the bombing and the apprehension of Jahar Tsarnaev, then as he was tried, convicted, and eventually sentenced to death. Now, 5 years after that verdict, the victims' families and the city must revisit all of that pain and suffering again. On Friday, a panel of three federal appeals judges overturned Tsarnaev's death sentence. The guilty verdict and his life sentence still stands. And here with us to explain why the sentence was thrown out and what it means moving forward is Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
And also joining us is WBUR reporter emeritus David Boeri. David, I love saying that. Welcome back to you.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
And you, listeners, what do you make of the decision? Do you have any questions about why the death penalty sentence was overturned, or do you want to see another death penalty trial for Jahar Tsarnaev? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Judge Gertner, I want to start with you. Just in simplest sense, why was this sentence overturned? What did the judges say?
Well, the opinion was very interesting. The opinion said that the first question was whether or not venue belonged in Boston. And while two of the judges thought that it could be fairly tried, the case could fairly be tried in Boston, one thought it could not, they went on to say, but if you're going to try it in Boston, essentially, it had to be a careful and searching voir dire, the questioning of the jurors. And then they went through the judges' questioning and the jurors that had been left on, and they said, this really doesn't pass constitution. This doesn't pass muster. This doesn't pass muster under the case law. And in particular, you as a reporter would understand this, the difference. If I asked, if the jurors were asked what the lawyers wanted them to ask, what the defense wanted them to ask, which is, what have you read about the case? Juror then has to say, well, I remember this detail, and yes, I remember the inadmissible evidence here, and yes, I remember the torture of this person, etc. But instead of asking the what question, what did you hear about the case, the judge said whether what you've heard would make it difficult to be a juror. That meant that the juror had to decide whether they were fair, and none of the parties had any idea what this juror had actually read, seen, or heard.
And David, I want to turn to you in just a second here and on this question of voir dire, but Judge Gertner, I just have one more follow-up on this point. Why not just throw out the whole thing completely? Like, isn't it the same jury who convicted him on the other charges that the judges upheld, so wouldn't follow that those same issues with the juror questioning would apply to the rest of the case?
There was no rest of the case. Sure, there was a trial on whether or not he committed the crime, but that trial began with his defense lawyer saying he did it. So the only purpose of the trial on the question of whether he did the crime was to let the jury, which would be the same in the penalty phase, know the details of the offense. That was the only purpose. So the issue here was not, you know, supporting a verdict that really, of whether or not he did it, guilt or innocence, because he conceded that.
Mm-hmm.
The only issue in this case was the death penalty, and that's the issue going forward.
So, David, you covered this trial extensively for WBUR. We were at the courthouse every single day for the station, you and I. And you had major concerns then, at the start of the trial, about voir dire. What were those concerns?
It's stunning. It's stunning, Jamie, to go back because I attended voir dire every day. And it's stunning to go back and to look at my notes at the time and my reports and to see that all these issues that were ruled on last week were evident at the time. So the defense wanted to move the trial outside of Boston. And O'Toole had ruled against them several times. But he kept on saying, well, we don't need to because the time-tested method for identifying prejudice and whether a juror could actually set aside his beliefs and apply the presumption of innocence is voir dire. And so O'Toole embraced the faith. And then
O'Toole being the judge in the case.
Judge, yeah. I'm sorry, George O'Toole.
And voir dire being the questioning of the jurors.
The close questioning of the jurors to find prejudice and whether there was prejudice. And so he embraces the faith and then he goes forth proclaiming that his questioning is thorough and searching and therefore there's no reason to do as the defense wants, which is to move the venue out because he's going to find pre-trial prejudice through voir dire. But you know, proclaiming juries to be impartial and fair doesn't make them so. And last week in the Court of Appeals, they found that the voir dire that he did was not searching and it wasn't thorough. And the problem was Judge O'Toole allowed only limited questioning by the defense, and he wasn't very good at asking the questions himself. So I go back and looked at my notes. And when he'd ask a potential juror, every juror, whether she or he presumed that Tsarnaev was guilty, he'd then ask, can you set aside your opinion? To one woman, and I have the quote here, he said, would you be able to discipline your mind so you can make a decision based on evidence presented at trial rather than ideas you came with? Now, who wants to give the answers, no, Your Honor, I can't discipline my mind, or no, I can't be unbiased? And in its order, the appeals court ruled, and I'm reading from it, the judge stopped Jahar's counsel from asking prospective jurors questions like, what did you know about the facts of this case before you came to court today, if anything, and what stands out in your mind from everything you have heard, read, or seen about the Boston Marathon bombing in the events that followed it? These are content questions, not just did you hear or see or read something.
So, Judge Gertner, how common is that for a judge in a case like this to ask these types of questions?
That's hard to know, but it's certainly the best practice. And it certainly was outlined in the case that the Court of Appeals cited, this Patriarca case from 50 years ago. I mean, literally, that we're in a situation, a high-profile situation, you don't want the jury to simply say, don't worry, Judge, I'm fair. You've got to know what they know. And I used to regularly ask that when I was on the bench. The issue here is if you don't ask the what question, you wind up with the juror who was basically hanging on every TV detail, mm-hmm. or the juror who saw, Tsarnaev confess where he had not been warned, an unconstitutional confession, or maybe a juror who actually, wound up just sort of seeing all the details of the offense over and over again. You needed to know, you're picking, let me put it this way, you're picking amongst a pool that was already filled with details of this offense, of this incident, and you needed to be able to make fine distinctions amongst them. And this question didn't enable that at all.
And Jamie, if I may here,
yes,
what the appeals court ruled last week is it is not up for the jurors to determine whether or not they're prejudiced. It's up to the judge to determine that. So, for instance, he'd ask Judge O'Toole would ask potential jurors, and most of whom said they presumed Tsarnaev was guilty, whether they could set their presumption aside. And so a defense attorney, Joshua Dubin, told me at the time, you know, you can't ask someone if they could put aside their opinion. Where are they going to put it? Into a secret box in their brain? But O'Toole was ever confident. He never tired of telling everyone that, in fact, it was working. The appeals court last week writes, and this is damning, despite his best intentions, O'Toole did not meet the standards. His performance fell short of promise. And what they've ruled is that O'Toole qualified jurors who had already formed an opinion about that Tsarnaev was guilty, and he did so because they said they could decide the case on the evidence. He did this with 9 of the 12 jurors.
Right, including the foreperson, or the juror who
right.
became the foreperson,
right.
number 286, right?
Woman. That's right.
She was a restaurant manager. David, remind us a little bit about her.
Well, early on, when she was just a prospective juror, her testimony jumped out at me because the judge asked her if she would have any trouble if the evidence led that way to imposing a death penalty, to voting for the death penalty. And she said, as a restaurant manager, you know what? I don't fire people. They fire themselves. They fire themselves because of what they do. And I thought that was a sort of a shocking rationale. It would have been very easy for her to do it. And it was suggesting some prejudice. She got on the panel, despite the fact that, as the defense pointed out in a motion that the judge ruled against, she had referred to Tsarnaev as human garbage in a social media post. And there was another juror, a water meter reader, who also was engaged with social media communications. And he denied that he was involved, and then a few things came out. But the judge never specified. He didn't hone in on just what it was.
Well, and when the defense came up with problems with the foreperson, said, you know, hey, she had misrepresented to you whether she was on social media, the judge refused to have an investigation.
So let me ask you this, though. I mean, this is a pretty high-profile trial. And so wouldn't a court have had trouble finding any impartial jurors anywhere in the immediate aftermath of the attack, the first terror attack on U.S. soil since 9/11? Or was this a uniquely difficult thing here in Boston, something like, what, 2 miles from the finish line itself?
In my view, it was in any high-profile case in general, right? And in particular, given the social media and the incredible intensity of coverage today, getting a fair juror is, of course, difficult. And that's why the questioning of jurors is all the more important. This case, however, was uniquely difficult. And so essentially what the Court of Appeals was saying is these errors in voir dire had a very different resonance now in this case with this jury. And these were not just little errors. I mean, they were major errors. The notion of not even investigating a juror who you can show lied to you or voir dire and didn't relate something on voir dire is a substantial error.
But there was a huge jury pool, Nancy. There was a huge pool. I'm not sure why they had to accept people who presumed he was guilty. They had enough people, enough in that pool that they could have presumed innocence and struck that from that direction to seat a jury.
They could have, yes. They could have. There's no question about it.
So, unfortunately, you know, the clock ticks by. So I do want to ask you both where this goes from here. So I noted at the top that the guilty verdict still stands. We talked about that a little bit. Does that mean he, Tsarnaev, if the federal government decides not to continue with another federal prosecution, death penalty prosecution, does his life without parole stand?
Yes. He's already admitted, he's already confessed. He's already essentially said he would accept life without parole. His lawyer said that on his behalf. So if there's no additional death penalty phase here, he would get life without parole. If there's an additional death penalty phase and the jury does not give him death, he gets life without parole. And the death phase will look very different than it did before because there was information about the confession. If you recall, there was a Waltham murder, a triple slaying. The victims had their throat cut. The older brother was associated with that, and more than just associated, the co-defendant with him, the guy who did the crime with him, confessed to the crime, told the police the details, told the feds.
That was Tadashev in Florida.
Tadashev,
right?
That's right. And the recordings of his confession were kept from the defense. And in fact, the government went so far as to say that really details of this particularly brutal killing should not go before the jury that was hearing death. The defense for Tsarnaev was saying they need to hear this because Tsarnaev wasn't involved in this slaying, but the fact that the younger brother wasn't involved, but the brutality of the slaying, the fact that the younger brother learned of it afterwards, raised the argument as to whether or not he thought he had no choice but to participate in this crime, else the same result would befall him. Whether a jury accepted that argument would be another question.
I do want to ask how ironclad this idea of life without parole is, because I know that that's one of the issues that sort of split victim families, right? The family of Martin Richard, the 8-year-old boy who was killed at the finish line, they were opposed to the death penalty because they didn't want these lengthy, long appeals. But there is something finite, right, about death. It's fine. It's done. And there's no possibility of any books being written or propaganda being spread. So I'm curious, is life without parole truly life without parole?
It is truly life without parole. I mean, those are the conditions. And heinous, cruel, depraved, absolutely he fits the bill. But the question here is whether to go forward, which they'll need to do if they want to impose the death penalty. And having been in that courtroom every day, and I know you were there, Jamie, it is striking. The trauma in that room is unforgettable to me as we speak. It was soul-searching pain that waved over the jurors. The jurors, reporters, courtroom personnel, all crying. I remember tapes of shrieking, of relentless shrieking that I can still hear. It was an experience that just drained the oxygen out of the room.
I remember, David. There were some videos that were so moving or horrific that they didn't even show us as the reporters.
Descriptions of blood falling out of the sky like debris. The question is, do you go forward? Well, there was a legitimate and understandable difference amongst victims and families. The Richards family submitted a letter before the trial began that the death penalty could bring years of appeals and reliving the most painful day of all our lives. We can only start rebuilding our lives and family when Tsarnaev fades from the media spotlight. Well, this unfortunately is what happens when you have the death penalty, that there are years and decades that go by and a tremendous expense. And this possibility that it's going to be overturned, there's going to be an appeal.
So I do want to play a little sound here. I spoke with Liz Norden. She's the mother of sons Paul and JP. They each lost a leg in the bombing, and she supported the death penalty. And here's what she said about the possibility of another trial.
You know, it's been 7 years, and we live it every day, but somewhat of normalcy has set in, and you can kind of move on and move forward, and then they have to go through it all over again. Really just sucks. So I will go. I went every day, almost every day, for the first trial and sat through it all, and I will do it again wherever it may be.
So in our final moments here, I'm just wondering from each of you what this will mean for the city of Boston going forward.
I think it's clear that it will mean another, tortured story. It would be one thing if going through this again would mean would be final, but there will be other appeals again if the verdict is the same. The system requires that when death is in the balance. You have to be able to exhaust your appeals. If it ends with now or ends with a verdict of life without parole, that will be the end. There's no question about that. That will be the end. Life without parole in the federal system means precisely that. And certainly someone accused of this kind of crime is not ever getting out.
David?
You look at the future here, and it may be imposed from the outside, or this may be influenced by external forces. You know, the president has already made his views clear.
Yeah, he wants there to be another death penalty do-over, as he calls it.
And he's waging a war on for law and order. And so he's made it clear what he wants to happen. And there's an election coming up, so that, there are external forces here. And there are people that legitimately want the death penalty. And as it raises deep, deep, deep questions. I mean, what is justice in the end? Seems to me that justice is Martin Richards coming to life and people being restored with legs and arms. We don't have justice in that sort, and we're not going to get it.
No, we'll never see justice in that sense, David. Thank you. It's WBUR reporter emeritus David Boeri. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thank you as well.
Thank you.